This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A Bloomington Normal College professor spent her summer interviewing children about conditions at U.S. immigration facilities.
Worse than everything you've heard. It was shocking. It was really difficult to spend time in those facilities.
Kathleen O'Gorman tells WGLT's Ryan Denham about her work with the Center for Human Rights and Constitutional Law. Plus, ISU President Larry Dietz has been a happy camper lately. New dorm project, multi-million dollar gift to ISU, enrollment up, things like that. He's telling the campus about it in his State of the University speech. The abolitionist and suffragette Sojourner Truth came to Bloomington 140 years ago. We'll talk with a reenactor who marks the occasion. And the mayor of Normal drops by. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Normal town staff have briefed the town council on financial trends. And here to chew over the report is the mayor of Normal, Chris Coos. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, good to be here.
Finance Director Andrew Hune reports every year. This year, not a lot different. A generally positive outlook, some longer-term concerns. The general fund balance stood at close to $16 million, up from just over $14 million a year ago. Of the 34 fiscal indicators included in the report, 21 he identified as positive, only 7 negative. How do you assess the report, Mayor, at the 30,000-foot level?
Well, I'd have to say, you know, initially we've made a little progress. We've taken a step in the right direction. Andrew Hune talked last night that there are things we have to, that we've rated positive that we need to keep an eye on.
Like what?
So, I think state income tax, local income tax, while there's growth there, you know, we're not seeing what we consider a strong trend like we saw in the early 2000s. So things like that, we're moving in the right direction, but we need to be watchful.
Per capita income in Bloomington Normal, not just Normal, is rising. It is not rising as fast as it used to. Is how much adjustment will municipalities have to make since the growth curve is slower now?
Well, I think one thing that we found out last night, you know, is we do have a declining workforce, and that's a negative issue that was brought up. But sales tax revenues were increasing slightly, so people are spending and spending a little bit more. So consumer confidence, I think, in the community is good, but it's something we have to be watchful on.
We are, you know, 10 years into an economic expansion. There are some economists that think a recession could be happening. Is that something that you have to pre-plan for, or do you react to that as a municipality?
You know, I think a little bit of both. Our financial people, in-house and out-of-house, do monitor that pretty closely. And if we see some trends that would point to a recession, I think we're watchful in that regard. But to be able to predict it, I mean, if Mr. Hune could predict a recession,
he wouldn't be working for the town.
That's
right.
The
report pointed to a large spike in prescription expenses, causing the significant reduction in the health and dental fund balance over the last 3 years. The amount spent on life-saving specialty drugs rose from under $150,000 in the 2013 year to more than $1 million in each of the last 2 years. Is that likely to remain the case?
We think the trend is there. We don't know if it's going to accelerate the way it has in the last couple of years, and it has to do especially drug pricing. We're seeing, as everybody in the United States is on specialty drugs, we're seeing incredible inflation of pricing.
So how do you address that in the next budget cycle? What do you do?
What we're doing is we're trying to increase our wellness activities within the town, and that has helped in a certain regard. You know, helping people monitor their day-to-day health and practices to help that. I think, you know, we're looking at the federal government, who kind of dances around the idea that they're going to take on this problem of rising prescription costs, where, you know, a dose of, or a prescription of insulin might cost $400 in the United States. In Australia, it's $48.
Does the town want to depend on federal action in its planning process?
I don't know what other option we have. I mean, we're far enough down the food chain that we can't be the catalyst to change that pricing structure.
No, but you can say, okay, we are not counting on federal action, and therefore there must be an additional set-aside and an opportunity cost of things that we cannot do because of this.
Yeah, I would agree that that could be an option, that there's going to be higher copays, things like that. We don't want to do that, and we acknowledge that our fund balance is low, so we're going to have to make some of those kinds of decisions.
So does that mean that you might consider not being self-insured anymore or part of the municipal risk pool?
I don't think we're there yet.
Okay, what would that take? And
you're going to have to ask the people that are in the trenches on that one.
Okay. Why not a more systemic change, though? Are you satisfied, largely, even with this?
Well, we're able to manage at this point. No, we're not satisfied that we have to get that fund balance up higher. But, you know, we value the health and quality of life of our employees. And as long as we can maintain that, we're going to do that.
You've mentioned a couple of areas of concern. Other uncertainties or areas of concern? State uncertainties?
I think state uncertainties is a big issue for us. A couple of years ago, they took 10% of our 1% share. They called it administrative cost, but it was basically they needed some dollars to plug some holes in their budget. It was reduced last year to 5%. The Illinois Municipal League is working to reduce it even further. And so that has impacted us. And we all know the state budget issue is a huge problem. It's going to have to be addressed. But we're looking out for municipalities.
Governor Pritzker last week sent out a memo to state agencies asking them to plan for a 6% cut.
Mm-hmm.
Would there be trickle-down effects if that cut materializes to municipalities in terms of services that the state will no longer provide, or delays in providing those services caused by the cuts?
Well, until we see the detail of what that cut looks like, I couldn't answer that directly. But obviously, the short answer is yes, it could affect us and the cost of us taking up services the state no longer does.
Fire and police pension contributions remain a concern, as they have for many years now. According to state law, those pension plans need to reach a 90% funding level by the year 2040. Currently, the police pension funding in the town of Normal is 56%, the fire pension plan at 62%. At present rates, will the town reach adequacy by the 2040 deadline?
Well, we're still working at a 100% by 2040. That's our goal. Now, we may have to drop back to the state 90% funding level, but the issues have been, probably the largest issue is dwindling interest income. You know, interest rates are so low, and what we're making on our investments, we were at 7.5% a few years ago. We're at 6.75%, and we're taking a hard look at that. Maybe that needs to go down again, too.
Hey, Andrew Hune, the finance director for the town, said one possible solution is for the council to adjust its projections to be a little more conservative in terms of its interest earning projections, as you just mentioned. That would, though, require an increase in the annual payments toward the pension fund. We're not going to get there mm-hmm. with the investment income, we're going to have to put in more up front. So,
well, traditionally, Charlie, we have taken our property tax levy and put it, I'd say, 90% of that toward pension funding. And we've 2 years ago, we had to do a bump that none of us liked to maintain that pension funding level. We're going to have some hard questions to ask during the budget process in terms of, is that scenario still valid for us to do that? Do we need to look at other sources of funding within the town? And if we do, what gets cut?
What's your sense of your own preferences?
My preference would be to stay the course, but I don't know if we realistically can do that. And we haven't gotten into the hard discussions on that yet. That's coming up probably in December, January.
There is a schedule of payments, right, that you're currently making and planning to make in the out years all the way through 2040.
Yes, and those are determined by an actuary service.
Okay. Do you have to rely on the actuary service, or can you be even more conservative than they are?
We do not need to rely on them, and some communities don't. They ignore the recommendations and underfund, I think. We have funded according to their recommendations, and that will be our goal going forward.
This is
now, we may have to, again, go from 100% by 2040 to 90% by 2040.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Finance Director Andrew Hune says his department is hopeful the state will make pension relief available. State lawmakers haven't moved the needle on state worker pension inadequacy. Do you share his hope they will get it together and offer relief for municipalities?
I think it would be important to do. One of the things that the Illinois Municipal League, and I'm headed for a board meeting on Thursday for this, one of our primary issues is consolidation of police pension funds and fire prevention funds, or pension funds. If you take a look at IMRF, which is all the other employees within the town, that pension fund is performing pretty well. Police funds, fire funds, there are hundreds of them. And the idea of consolidating them, you're bringing more capital to the table, and hopefully you can get better managed returns out of those funds.
But you have also differing obligations and differing pension benefit schemes and plans throughout all of these municipalities.
That's true, but it doesn't mean we can't consolidate. It's not everybody does the same. They can continue to fund their funds the way they see fit, but the consolidation of the fund in terms of managing those dollars would be much more efficient.
Some municipalities are going to say, you know, we really don't like the loss of local control. I mean, is it going to be possible to get consensus on this?
I think so. I think, you know, at least and there are probably 30 board members in the Illinois Municipal League representing cities large and small all over the state of Illinois, and there seems to be pretty unanimous agreement that this is something we need to do.
Final thoughts on the financial trends report?
A good outlook for the town. The town is solid financially, but as always, we have work to do.
The mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us most Tuesdays after Monday night council meetings. Mayor Chris Goose, thanks for talking about the financial trends.
Great conversation. Thank you.
Next week, it's Mayor Terry Renner of Bloomington. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from SmartVet, the only mobile veterinary practice serving the Bloomington Normal area. Your pet's healthcare experience is simplified when the vet comes to you. Details at thesmartvet.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. In just a few minutes, Sojourner Truth, or a reenactor thereof, returns to Bloomington 140 years after her first appearance. Illinois State University is coming off a few good weeks. A rise in enrollment, the announcement of a new $100 million residence hall project, a record individual gift to the University College of Fine Arts and School of Art, $12 million. Illinois State University President Larry Dietz is talking about all of those things in his annual State of the University speech today. President Dietz came to the WGLT studios to talk about those and other issues as well. Recovery from the two-year budget standoff remains a work in progress, for instance. Dietz says ISU is doing okay with Governor Pritzker's budget that includes an overall 5% increase in higher education funding in the state.
The right word is reinvestment, and that's what a lot of folks have been talking about. The governor has been talking about a reinvestment in higher education, and I think that's the right word. You know, our low point was when we didn't have a budget, and so we're still not back to the 2015 level, but 5% helps us get there. But I think the other part of the budget is having a capital budget also is helping greatly, and so That's going to be spread over 6 years. So I think managing expectations that we're not running around with dollars falling out of our pockets because not a penny of that has been released yet, and they're still talking about how and when to do that. But it'll be spread over 6 years, but a capital budget's appreciated. There's also money for some deferred maintenance in that budget, and we appreciate that. And most importantly, there's an increase in MAP funding and the Aim High program as a relatively new program. And so all of that goes to students. So we're delighted about all of that. But it is a reinvestment. We're not back to where we were by any stretch, either to 2015 or back when a lot of people said was kind of the heyday, which was 2002.
Governor Pritzker recently sent a memo to many state agencies and some providers as well, asking them to prepare for up to a 6% budget cut next year. After the 5% increase for higher education, I'm guessing ISU did not get that memo?
We did not get that. I think the memo that was really applying to agencies, state agencies, and we are not a code agency by definition. We are frugal with the amount of money that we've been given, and so we don't feel well healed by any stretch, but the 5% increase is fulfilling his promise of a reinvestment in higher education.
I had to ask that question anyway.
Yep.
How's Redbird Rising doing, the comprehensive campaign?
Well, it's doing great. Last week was a historic week in that we received our largest cash gift in the history of the institution. It was a $12 million gift from Wansuk Kim and her husband, Thomas Clement. And it named the College of Fine Arts and the School of Art after Wansuk Kim. And so we're pleased to have her name on both of those programs, but the $12 million was obviously a huge boost. We're at about $163 million, a little bit over that right now, and we're going to keep our foot on the gas and just keep on working. Campaign ends June 30th of next year, and our hope is that we already exceeded our goal, but our hope is that our alumni and friends will continue to help us blow that original goal out of the water.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Our guest today is Illinois State University President Larry Dietz. A year ago, you announced that planning would begin on a campus multicultural center. What's going to go into that center as far as what the purposes of that will be?
Well, as our student population has become a lot more diverse over time, students have expressed an interest in the multicultural center. That idea really grew out of a campus climate task force that I started when I first became president of the university. And so this is a natural outgrowth, I would say, of that those original recommendations. The kinds of things that go into a multicultural center, we had a task force that went around the countryside. Well, didn't go a long way around the countryside, but visited some campuses that did have centers and talked about what might be exported, if you will, ideas from those centers and what we might have. I think there'll be programming that will come out of there. The diversity advocacy staff, I think, will play an important role there. There'll be meditation rooms. There'll be a kitchen for some social programming. I think some room for some satellite student services to come in every now and then and talk about, you know, financial aid or career issues and so forth. So I think it's really going to be a boon for students. And I think we'll also have some faculty that will come in every now and then, too, to not only help our students with mentoring issues, but I think mainly the thing is going to be a functional area, but also very symbolic to our continually diverse student population.
And where will it be?
It will be in the current place where the Center for Teaching and Learning currently exists. They're moving to a temporary location to get ready for a more permanent location in the library. They're moving out. They are located in Williams Hall right now, and they'll be there for the time to plan for their new housing over in the library. So once they get out, we'll move We've got to do some renovation, not extensive, but a little bit of renovation. And so if we've followed the plan, and our plan is to follow the plan, if everything works the way it's supposed to in terms of timing, this time next year we'll have an operational multicultural center.
Traffic through the Bone Student Center has increased dramatically as the renovations there have gone on. How will you manage functions of a multicultural center and the Bone Student Center, which ought to be both heavy-duty student gathering places, to avoid overlap and each cannibalizing the other?
Well, the Bone Student Center is a location that obviously offers a lot of food venues, a lot of other business venues that are there. The Multicultural Center will be a gathering place for anybody is welcome there, but I think the predominant population that will come will be underrepresented students. But in addition, we anticipate our Pride organization will be there as well. But it's not the same kind of function that the Bone Student Center would be. It's a very different, kinds of offerings for students. And the other part of that is that, frankly, we'll know a lot more after a couple of years of operation of the Multicultural Center what the traffic pattern will be. This is the first for the university, and we're going to think we've programmed it well, but I think we also will know more after we operate it for a year or two.
ISU recently announced a $100 million plus residence hall project to go in the space that formerly held Atkin, Colby, and Hamilton Witten.
Right.
1,200 beds. How do you anticipate construction on that will affect traffic flow and campus usage?
Well, we've got a lot more design work to do on that. The announcement about the 1,200 beds, it's really up to 1,200 beds. We have some ideas as to how that might work. Our Gilbain and Associates are the group that will be helping us with that. I think, during the construction part of that, obviously, we will be mindful of all the traffic on Main Street. There's not a ton of foot traffic through that land right now. So I don't think that's going to be as big of an issue as it will the phased construction part of that. So, Main Street's going to continue to operate the way Main Street's operated. We've got enough land there that I think our construction folks will be able to maneuver around on that and for it not to be a major roadblock for folks.
A year ago, you had said you were going to meet with rental property owners in the community in advance of this.
Right.
And how has that worked out? Are they upset about this project as they were worried about the prospect of it?
Well, I think they're concerned any time about housing. They want to be full. We want to be full. And the issue for us is that the housing of freshmen and sophomore students on campus has been a part of our policy for many, many years. And as we've torn down housing for some of our students due to a whole variety of issues, age, et cetera, those have not been replaced very much. We have a Cardinal Court that helped out, but we still have a real deficit in terms of our policy and the actual implementation of that. So this 1,200 bed new bed construction will certainly help us live into that policy that we've had for a long period of time. I think that having conversations with our off-campus folks are always important to do. The thing that I can tell them that I hope will happen is that if we're not able to retain freshmen and sophomore students, they're not going to be able to get them as juniors and seniors. And so I think our retention efforts will help them stay here and that they'll simply just get them at the junior and senior level. So we've had good discussions. We haven't always agreed on the outcome of those things, but I think discussion is always important.
The campus master plan says right up front that it is not written in stone, that it is always a work in progress. Right. But the current iteration of the campus master plan has that former Atkin, Colby, Hamilton, Witten space allocated for a new Mennonite College of Nursing. Since we're going to put a residence hall there, where will Mennonite go?
Sure. Mennonite College, a new building, is still on the list. It will continue to be on the list for capital improvements. The issue is that we've spent a good deal of money north of the campus, up north of the Bowen Student Center, building a new nursing simulation lab. Our hope is that we'll have another one up there. And so we own quite a bit of land in that area, and my sense is that that may be a better location for a new Mennonite College of Nursing.
So would that lab space then be folded into a new Mennonite College of Nursing? It was originally scheduled to be temporary and has a limited lifespan because of the construction methods.
Right. Well, first thing is that there is no money for a Mennonite, new Mennonite College of Nursing. The new capital bill helped us with fine arts, and that's still on the list, but the fine arts have been on the list for 10 years. Milner Library. There's approval for renovation of Milner Library. That's also been on the list for 10 years. So those two projects have been, they're moving to a different spot in terms of planning for the state. There is no money for a college of nursing at this point, a new college of nursing. We're going to continue to advocate for that, but in terms of any imminent money coming for that, it's not there. And so as we begin to plan differently for different spaces on the campus, I think that north part of the campus would be a good spot, though we have some folks that are going to be coming in and helping us with space planning and looking at that. But the other issue is that we really don't have any close-in space other than that space right there for a large residence hall complex.
Prospective donors for a Mennonite College of Nursing, take note. They have an opportunity there.
Thank you.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. ISU President Larry Dietz is our guest today. A couple of years ago, ISU became the first public university in the state to begin a cybersecurity major. And Jana Albrecht in Enrollment Management tells WGLT that the popularity of that major has played a role in the campus success and having a stable to growing enrollment in freshmen. Is it to the point that major needs its own space?
Yes. Matter of fact, we have just received approval from the Board of Trustees to renovate space in Julian Hall. The bottom floor of Julian Hall has been a parking space for faculty and staff, and that has been designated as a part of the area that we will build lab space in there for cybersecurity students. So Janet's exactly right. The program has grown like Topsy. We need some extra space for that. State Farm has helped us get that program established, and we want to be good stewards of that money as well. And so that we've already started part of that, and that we've this fall, including myself, have relocated people that had been used to parking in that facility to other spaces. And so the building is cordoned off right now, and we'll be looking at plans for renovation of Julian very quickly.
In the next year, what are you going to focus on?
Well, lots of things. Enrollment is something that's always important. The fundraising campaign has another year to go, and so I've been, for the last several years, traveling quite a bit, meeting with alumni groups and potential donors, so I'll continue to do that. Our international initiative is doing well. We were up 13% this year, but that has been a little bit of a challenge, just giving the international dimension in the United States, but we're doing well with that, so I'll continue to be involved with that to a degree. Also, engineering is something that we're looking at, and I would imagine I'll be spending some time talking with groups and trying to bolster that idea of having an engineering program at the university. And we've had a number of those faculty who have recommended that we have engineering program really only in two areas. So I don't envision a big college of engineering and those kinds of things, but we will need some additional classroom space to accommodate engineering. But right now we're only looking at mechanical and electrical. I think those are two areas that are in high demand. The state of Illinois, through the existing engineering programs throughout the state, are not producing enough engineers to meet the workforce demands of business and industry. So there's a need for it. And I think it'll also help us bolster our enrollments, because the students also want to study in those areas. And some of them can't get into some other programs, and they're really good students. But I think that it'll help, improve the academic profile of the institution. And so I think a lot of the indicators are pretty strong.
So is that 2 years away, 3 years away?
I think, certainly if we're talking about a building, it takes a year and a half to design a building and a year and a half to build it. And that's almost true of regardless of what kind of facility that you're talking about. So if we're looking at a facility, and I think we probably would need that, a good 3 years away. But the faculty need to be involved in the curricular development part of that, and we'll need some other folks that have expertise outside of our campus right now to look at building design and capacity and space requirements.
Where might that go?
Well, there's several locations that we're looking at. Again, there's a lot of space north of the campus. Well, there's some parking lots there. There's a number of other structures that we own in that particular area. So that's a candidate. But this group that's coming in to help us with our campus revision of our campus master plan and space study are going to help us with that as well.
Illinois State University President Larry Dietz, thanks so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Charlie. Thank you.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Support for WGLT comes from Colet Vacations, taking WGLT to Portugal and its islands in 2020. You'll experience Portugal's most beautiful regions, experience old world traditions, coastal villages, regional wines, and more. Travel details at WGLT.org, with trip reservations due by September 28th.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, how an Illinois Wesleyan University professor spent her summer talking to young kids detained at the border. Groups in Bloomington Normal will be reviving the memory of the abolitionist, activist, and suffragette Sojourner Truth this week. Born a slave in New York, Sojourner Truth emancipated herself in the 1820s and spent her life advocating for equal freedoms for women and people of color. She was on the lecture circuit in the mid and late 19th century and stopped in Bloomington 140 years ago tomorrow. In 1879, Sojourner Truth gave a speech at Second Presbyterian Church. Historian Greg Coos uncovered a newspaper clipping during a research for a book, and tomorrow, Springfield-based reenactor Tricia James Davis will play the civil rights and women's suffrage icon at Second Pres. In this interview, Davis talks about her approach to reenactment and says the resonance of Truth's message 140 years later rings true.
She was en route to Kansas City. And one way she raised money to support herself was to have speaking engagements. So that's primarily the reason why she stopped in Bloomington to have a speaking engagement, and also to talk about those things that were near and dear to her heart, women's suffrage. And at that time, since slavery had been abolished by the Emancipation Proclamation, she was still for justice and equal treatment of the former slaves. But so she spoke about those things in addition to talking about her life from slavery to her own freedom.
A lot of people view her, her most famous speech is "Ain't I a Woman?" And that is frequently at the time and since then done in a southern dialect, but that's inaccurate.
That is correct, because she did not have a southern dialect. She did have a bit of an accent because Dutch was her native tongue, but no, she never lived in the south, so she did not have a southern dialect. And I do know some people's rendition of that speech is done with a southern dialect. However, I do not do it with a southern dialect.
How do you approach creating a voice for her?
She had a heavy voice, which, depending on where I'm doing a presentation on her, I will affect a heavier voice than what I'm using now, with a twinge of an accent.
What do you mean heavy?
It has more of a male tone to it, more of a maybe not quite baritone, but heavier than my voice right now.
She grew up in New York. She was a slave in New York before New York abolished slavery. She had several children, five in all, and walked away from them. She was sold at one point for $100 with a flock of sheep. How did that influence her personality and her fight for abolition and later for the 40 acres and a mule land grants that freed slaves were entitled to?
I think that being a slave and mistreated and beat and considered to be less than a person affected her overall personality more than just a few incidents in her life. Of course, yes, she was enslaved in New York. New York was a slave state until 1827. However, she freed herself in 1826. Her slaveholder at that time had promised her freedom prior to the emancipation of slavery in New York. And he reneged on that promise, so she freed herself. She did not take her children. They were younger at that point, and she knew that when slavery was abolished, that her daughters would, when they reached age, become free. She did take with her, when she walked away from her slaveholder, her infant child, Sophie, who was still at the point of suckling on her breast. So she took that child with her, but later on returned her to live with her daughters, who remained at the farm where they had been enslaved. I think that just slavery itself was something that put a flame in her heart and in her soul to fight for justice and right for people of color. And then, of course, being a female, after she was released from slavery, she still felt in bondage because women had no rights at all in this country. And she saw the parallels there of the injustices and inequality to women to slavery.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Tricia James Davis, a Sojourner Truth reenactor who will be performing September 18th in Bloomington Normal. So how do you think her speech went over in Bloomington Normal? Are there records?
I have not seen records. I've only seen some newspaper clippings of the event, which say it was well attended and well received.
And at that era, 1879, she would have been focusing as much on women's suffrage as anything else, it seems.
She would have been, because women still had not received the right to vote. You know, the 19th and 20th Amendments had not even been presented at that time. So she was still talking about justice and actually freedom for all women.
In studying her life, We've talked a little bit about her history at a very surface level, but you've looked into her deeply. What do you want the public and people to know that is relevant today, that from her life and from your studies?
You know, it's an interesting question, because many of the things, all of the things that she was fighting for and advocated for, still need that same type of people to fight for it these days. Women, even though they have made huge strides in this country, women still, in a lot of professions and in a lot of cases, earn less than men. Women are still really struggling to attain political office. Women are still not looked at as being equally qualified as men. So I think that issue is still very prevalent. I think that there are some huge issues regarding race in this country. So I think that the things that she was fighting for and advocating for would certainly be appropriate today.
How do you bring out those issues in your reenactments? What selections from her speeches and rhetoric do you focus on?
I mainly focus on reminiscing about her life. I do talk about the fact that she dedicated the last part of her life, from 45 on, to fighting and advocating for equal rights and justice for women and also for people of color. I don't do it in a militant or accusatory way at all.
Is that her way?
I don't know. I think she told the truth about the issues and the treatment of women and people of color. I think she told the truth, but I don't think it was done in an accusatory or a guilt-implementing way.
That's Sojourner Truth reenactor, Tricia James Davis of Springfield. The Sojourner Truth celebration will be 7 p.m. tomorrow at Second Presbyterian Church in Bloomington with the choirs of Second Pres, Wayman AME Church, and Mount Pisgah Baptist Church. Also performing admission. Yeah, that's free. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois Wesleyan University professor Kathleen O'Gorman spent her summer on the front lines of America's broken immigration system. O'Gorman is fluent in Spanish. She interviewed children detained at U.S. immigration centers on behalf of the Center for Human Rights and Constitutional Law. Their mission is to ensure children are being treated properly and in accordance with the Flores Settlement, a 1990s-era decree that governs how we treat minors trying to enter the U.S. O'Gorman will talk about her experiences tonight for the Immigration Project and Illinois State University's Latino and Latin American Studies program in Williams Hall at ISU. In this encore interview, O'Gorman tells WGLT's Ryan Denham why she volunteered for the work and how things changed this summer when she finally got to see Border Patrol facilities.
That is where what we saw was so egregious, so horrifying, that we had to go public. We had to save these children's lives. There were children who were desperately sick. And so that was clear.
Obviously, we want to get into the conditions that you're witnessing. But first, talk a little bit more about the actual work you're doing once you're at one of these places. So you said six different visits to various places. What are you literally doing while you're there?
We inspect the premises in terms of visiting where they sleep, where they eat. We meet with people who are usually the director and other personnel who are directly involved with working with the children. And we have an opportunity to ask them questions. They can ask us questions. There's a representative there from the U.S. Department of Justice. They are making sure that we don't violate the Flores Settlement conventions, and we are there to make sure they're not violating the conventions. So that's what we're primarily doing, is to see if the agreement, the Flores Settlement Agreement, is adhered to by the government. And the way in which we do that is checking the facilities, as I say, speaking with the personnel, and then most importantly, meeting with individual children who are detained there. So we get a census, we get a list of all the children who are detained in the facility on that day, and then we select which children we want to see, or they have been asked in advance if they would like to speak with us. And then the people at the facility go and retrieve the children, bring them to us, and we interview them.
What are the types of questions that you ask these kids?
We have a list of questions that we've been given by the Center for Human Rights and Constitutional Law, and they're all keyed to the Flores Settlement. So we're asking them about their treatment. We're asking them about how, where they sleep, how they sleep, what kind of discipline is used with them, if they have access to clean facilities, if they are being given adequate time to go to classes, if they're having recreational opportunities, all of the elements that are keyed to the Flores Settlement, if they can attend services for their religious faith, if they have any kind of problems. We ask them if there are questions, that they have for us, obviously, or if there are things that they want to tell us. And we give them as much control as possible over the interview. They don't have to answer anything. They don't have to meet with us if they don't want to. So it's important for us to give them control. And they know that. They can stop at any time. They don't have to start. So it's very much an opportunity for them to tell us what they think we should know.
How old are they?
When we have visited the facilities other than the Border Patrol facilities, and I'll talk about those in a minute because that's different, We can only see children up to the age of 18. Then they are moved to the adult facility. So we see them under that age. Up until we visited the Border Patrol facilities, we did not interview children typically under the age of 10. And the reason for that is that we didn't want to re-traumatize them, for one thing, and ask them all kinds of questions about their circumstances. But we also felt that they wouldn't really be able to give us the kind of information that would be helpful for us to determine the broader sense of things in terms of the facility. The older children, by older, 10 years old, they could actually be a little bit fuller in their explanations of things. The children at the Border Patrol facilities, we wanted to see how the youngest were doing. So that meant we got the infants and their teenage mothers. So in McAllen, Texas, we did infants and teenage mothers. In Clint, the second Border Patrol facility that I went to, we did not interview, because there were not many teen mothers with infants. So there we saw children who were 2, 3, 4, 5. We went for young children, but we also had teenagers there.
So there's been a lot of reporting from the government facilities at the border. I think in the last several months, there's been media outlets that have tried to paint a picture of how bad the conditions are in some of these places. I know you've seen a lot of different places and a lot of different types of facilities, not all of which were at the border itself, but in your own words, what were the conditions like in some of the places you were in? How bad was it really?
Worse than everything you've heard. It was shocking. It was really difficult to spend time in those facilities for many reasons. I mean, emotionally, it was very, very difficult to continue the conversations when you knew, because of what the children were saying, what the conditions were. And I'll give you one example. One of the things that doesn't show up in all the reports that you see, the reports will document the facilities, but you don't see, for example, that the toilets in many of the cages are in the middle of the cage, and there's no privacy. So these children, every single day, multiple times a day, are humiliated by their own bodies, by that lack of privacy, by that lack of dignity to have any privacy. And imagine what a teenage girl is experiencing in that condition. She gets her period. How do you manage that in public, in effect? And in some of the cages, they were close enough to the boys' cage that they could see one another. There were so many cases of interviews that we came away from, and it was clear to us, and it was certainly clear to me, the cruelty is the point. There were so many different elements of it that were gratuitously cruel.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm speaking with Kathleen O'Gorman, a professor from Illinois Wesleyan University, who recently spent time interviewing children being held by federal government officials in immigration centers on behalf of the Center for Human Rights and Constitutional Law. So, Kathleen, with any particular children that have stuck with you, you know, individual stories, or things that you've heard, kids that you're sitting across the table from that even today are still with you?
Oh, yes. All of them are still with me. But some of those that really stand out, you can hear my voice starting to get a little emotional. There were several. One was a little boy whom I was not interviewing. There were many of us in the room at the time. We would conduct several interviews simultaneously. But there was one little boy who was 5 or 6 years old, and he just stood there sobbing and sobbing, and he couldn't even tell us his name. It was so awful to witness this raw trauma. And this little boy just stood there. It ended up that we couldn't interview him. The lawyer that was trying to talk to him tried to console him as best she could, and ultimately we couldn't talk to him because he was unable to talk. He was so traumatized. We also had children who were silent. We had several children who were, well, for example, one child who was 2 years old, he had been separated from his aunt and put into this room full of children, of young girls, and the guards had said, somebody needs to take care of this child. And so an 8-year-old girl took care of him for a little bit, then she got sick of it, so then a 10-year-old child took care of him. We interviewed a child who was 13. She was the third child now taking care of this little boy. And this little boy never spoke, and he knew how to speak, but she said to us, he doesn't speak.
Kathleen O'Gorman of Illinois Wesleyan University has made 6 visits to U.S. immigration facilities, trips she pays for on her own. She offers a disclaimer. She speaks for herself, not on behalf of the Center for Human Rights and Constitutional Law. Her talk will be at 7 this evening in room 314 of Williams Hall at ISU for the Immigration Project and Latino and Latin American Studies program at ISU. She spoke here with GLT's Ryan Denham. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.